Welcome to the deep dive. So, if you turn on, pretty much any financial news channel, the absolute second inflation ticks upward, you're going to hear the exact same advice delivered with like absolute
Oh,
certainty.
totally. It's the ultimate Wall Street playbook.
Right. They tell you to sell growth and buy value. You're supposed to dump the tech companies, you rotate into those defensive stocks, look for low multiples, high dividends.
Yeah, the classic safe havens.
Exactly. It's treated like this immutable law of physics. But our mission for this deep dive, using a really fascinating source document we have today, is to ask a big question. What if we've been misdiagnosing the actual cause of death for 50 years?
I mean, it is a really provocative thought
Yeah.
because that consensus, it's basically been settled since the 1970s.
Yeah, no one questions it.
Right. But the research we're unpacking today argues that the entire financial world has just been looking at this backward. The historical data that Wall Street relies on isn't fabricated or anything, but their interpretation of it is, well, it's entirely wrong.
Which is a huge claim.
It is. They are fundamentally misidentifying what inflation actually punishes in an economy.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because they are confusing correlation with causation here. And if that standard playbook is completely broken, that changes how, anyone should look at markets or businesses or even their own personal
That
investments.
shakes everything, yeah.
But to figure out why the conventional wisdom is broken, we sort of have to start with this really uncomfortable reality about the words value and growth, because we treat them as if they're these fixed scientific terms.
Which they are absolutely not. I mean, the value versus growth debate has consumed academia and, well, fund management for half a century. People build entire careers on being like a strict value investor.
Right, it's their whole identity.
Exactly. Yet the definitions of these categories are constantly shifting. They're basically just administrative conveniences created by index providers, not actual economic realities.
Yeah, and I actually had to read this section of the source text twice because the absurdity of it is just so striking. It asks a really simple question, which is, what actually is value?
Right. Is it a low price to earnings ratio?
Or a high dividend yield? Or is it just whatever mechanically screens below the median line on some analyst's spreadsheet?
Yeah.
Because back in 1975, if you talked about a value stock, you meant like General Foods and Consolidated Edison.
Predictable, slow, boring companies.
Boring, exactly. But fast forward to 2026. If you go out and buy the S&P 500 value ETF today, your biggest holdings are Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan, and ExxonMobil.
Which are massively different entities.
Right. It seems totally ridiculous to suggest these are the exact same types of businesses simply because, a spreadsheet tagged them with the same label.
It's an illusion of categorization. You have all these major index providers, Dash S&P, MSCI, Russell, Morningstar, and they all use entirely different mechanical cutoffs.
Oh, so they don't even agree with each other.
Not at all. A stock can easily be classified as value by Morningstar and growth by Russell on the exact same trading day.
That's wild.
So when the market panics about inflation, and you have institutional money mindlessly rotating from the growth bucket to the value bucket, they are making these massive capital allocation decisions based on shifting arbitrary parameters.
It's like walking into this massive library and deciding to categorize all the books solely by the color of their dust jackets, completely ignoring what's actually printed on the pages.
That is a great way to put it.
Right, like you've got a cookbook, a romance novel, and a textbook on quantum physics, but they all have blue covers, so you just jam them in the blue section and assume they serve the exact same purpose.
Yeah. And if you're building an investment strategy based on the color of the dust jacket, you are setting yourself up for a terrible surprise when you actually open the book.
So true.
And that analogy hits the nail on the head. Because if those old labels are completely useless for understanding how a business will actually perform under the intense pressure of inflation, we need a totally new framework.
We have to basically strip away the labels.
Exactly. We have to look directly at the internal mechanics of the business itself.
Which brings us to a concept from the source that completely shifted how I view corporate structure. It's this framework that divides literally every business into two fundamental parts, the A and the B.
Yeah, the A and B model is just a brilliant distillation of corporate finance. Every business, regardless of what it actually sells, consists of these two elements.
Okay, break that down for us. What is the A?
The A is the toll. It basically represents the current earnings, the existing competitive moat, the immediate cash flow.
So the money coming in right now.
Right. In financial terms, we might call this the short duration of the business. It's what the company produces today, right now, using the assets it already has in place.
Wait, let me just pause you there really quick, because duration is typically a term we hear thrown around in the bond market, right? Not really with stocks. So how does duration apply to a company's equities?
Oh, that's a really great point of clarification. Because, yeah, in bonds, duration just measures how long it takes to get your money back.
Right.
But in equities, we use it to describe where a company's cash flows are located in time. So a short-duration company is generating massive cash right now.
Oh, I see.
Whereas a long-duration company might not generate any significant cash for, say, 10 years, meaning its value is highly, highly dependent on the future.
Okay, got it. So the A is that current toll, the short-duration cash flow, which leaves the B.
Right. The B is the growth. It's the future earnings, geographic expansion, you know, the development of new product lines.
This stuff that hasn't happened yet.
Exactly. It is the long-duration aspect of the business. It's what the company hopes to produce tomorrow.
So if we completely abandon that traditional value versus growth debate, the real question we should be asking when we look at any business isn't what's the PE ratio?
No, not at all.
The critical question becomes, what does the B cost?
Precisely. What is the actual literal price tag for this business to grow its footprint? Charlie Munger used to talk about this constantly.
Yeah, he was big on this.
He had a really great way of framing it. He noted that there are fundamentally two kinds of businesses. The first kind runs, let's say, 12%. And at the end of the year, you can just take that cash out and put it right in your pocket.
Must be nice.
Right. But the second kind also earns 12%. But every single cent of that excess cash must be aggressively reinvested just to keep the business running.
So there's never any actual cash left over for the owners?
Exactly. He famously compared that second type of business to a guy who points at a massive yard full of heavy machinery and says, "There's all my profit."
You can't spend a tractor.
No, you really can't. And Warren Buffett actually made a very similar observation back in around 2015. He warned that the absolute best businesses to own during an inflationary period are the ones you buy once.
And then you just never have to make subsequent capital investments to keep them going.
Exactly. They're both essentially warning us about what this research calls the expensive B. When a business has to pay heavily for its future, it becomes incredibly vulnerable.
Okay, let's ground this with some tangible examples of an expensive B, just so we can visualize it. Coca-Cola comes to mind.
Great example.
Because it has this incredible, globally recognized brand, right? But to maintain that brand dominance and actually grow its market share, they have to spend somewhere between $4 to $5 billion every single year just on marketing and advertising.
Right. If they stop spending, they literally lose shelf space and mind share. That is a very expensive B.
Or look at heavy industry. The railroad company, BNSF, is a classic example from the source.
Oh, yeah. The capital expenditure there is massive.
Right. To expand their capacity and grow their revenue, they have to spend billions of dollars on physical steel, new rails, new locomotives, the constant, never-ending maintenance of the existing infrastructure.
And then there's Exxon, which, you know, might just be the ultimate illustration of this trap.
Definitely.
Exxon has to spend tens of billions of dollars on exploration, deep water drilling, and, you know, really complex extraction simply to replace the oil reserves that they are actively depleting every single day.
So the growth is real, but it just requires this mountain of upfront capital to actually achieve it.
Right. Now take those specific businesses and drop them into a high inflation environment.
This is where things get ugly.
This is where we see the underlying physics of the company start to completely break down through a process we can call compounding degradation.
Compounding degradation. I like that phrase.
Yeah, because inflation relentlessly raises the cost of every single input. Raw materials, specialized labor, energy, and crucially, capital expenditures.
Meaning, okay, the factory that cost $500 million to build in the last economic cycle suddenly costs $600 million to build today.
Yes.
And the R&D project that used to cost $50 million is now going to cost $60 million just to get the exact same result.
Exactly. Every single dollar of retained earnings that the company reinvests into itself buys less growth than it did the year before.
Wow.
So the internal loop that converts their profits into future expansion, it has to run hotter and hotter, but it actually produces less and less actual growth.
It's like running on a treadmill, where the incline gets steeper with every single step you take, but your speed stays exactly the same. You eventually just burn out trying to maintain your position.
That's exactly what compounding degradation is.
I do have to challenge this a little bit, though, because if we're in an inflationary environment where everyone is just paying more for everything, revenues are naturally rising too, right?
They are, yes.
So if Exxon's oil sells for twice as much per barrel, or Coke can charge more per can, aren't they just flush with cash? Like, can't these companies just raise their prices to compensate for the higher costs of building that factory?
It's a very logical assumption. And, you know, pricing power is absolutely a defense mechanism, but it's an incomplete defense.
How so?
Well, here is the mathematical reality. Even if a company successfully raises prices without losing customers, which is hard enough, the margin between their revenue growth and their cost growth inevitably narrows.
Okay, walk me through the math there.
Let's say your revenues go up 10% because you hiked prices, but the cost of the steel and the labor required to build your next facility goes up 20%.
Oh, I see.
The spread collapses. Your pricing power might protect your current earnings, your A, but it cannot fully offset the hyperinflated cost of your future growth, your B.
Because the costs are compounding faster.
Right. You are working exponentially harder just to stand still.
Okay, the math there makes perfect sense. The cost of reinvestment outpaces the benefit of the price hikes. So if the expensive B is this sort of capital trap during inflation, what's the alternative? I mean, the opposite of an expensive B would have to be a free B. But how can growth possibly be free? In the business world, nothing is free.
It does sound like a total paradox until you look at the mechanics of a company like Visa. Visa completely breaks the traditional Wall Street screening models.
It really does, because if you run a mechanical screen right now, Visa trades at a price-to-earnings ratio of around 29.
Which is high.
Right.
Okay.
And it has this microscopic dividend yield of around 0.7%. So any standard financial algorithm just looks at those metrics, slap a growth stock label on Visa, and tells you to sell it the exact moment inflation ticks up.
But look past the label and actually examine the internal engine of the company. Visa regularly grows its free cash flow at 12 to 15% a year.
That's huge.
And on top of that, it manages to return roughly 4% to its shareholders annually through a combination of stock buybacks and dividends.
Which raises a really glaring question. If Visa is supposedly this high-flying growth stock that is expanding rapidly, how do they have all this excess cash left over to just hand back to shareholders? Where's the capital expenditure?
That is the revelation right there. Visa does not pay for its own growth.
They don't.
No, think about it. Even today, a massive percentage of global transactions, roughly 85% in many emerging markets, are still conducted in cash.
Oh, wow. 85%.
Yeah. So the global economy is naturally, structurally moving toward digitization. Visa doesn't have to build a billion-dollar factory to make that happen.
Right.
They don't have to fund a massive R&D labs to convince people to shop online. The world is digitizing itself. Visa simply provides the infrastructure to capture that shift.
It's like a toll booth operator positioned on a major highway. The city is constantly adding new lanes to the highway to accommodate more traffic, but the toll booth operator never has to pay a single dime to pave the new asphalt.
Exactly.
The traffic just naturally increases, the lanes expand, and the operator just sits there collecting more tolls.
I'd actually take that analogy even further. Not only do they not pay for the asphalt, they don't even have to hire more toll workers because the system is entirely automated.
Man, that is a good business.
Right. The growth arrives without effort. The wave is external, it's permanent, and the cost to ride it is effectively zero. The research refers to this specific type of business as a free surfer.
The free surfer. It's a great visual. And Visa isn't an isolated anomaly here. The research highlights other companies operating with this exact same dynamic.
Oh, yeah. There are a few really good examples.
Like MSCI. They provide the underlying indices for the massive structural shift from active mutual fund investing to passive ETF investing. Mm. That multi-trillion dollar shift is happening, whether MSCI spends capital to encourage it or not. Exactly.
Or take Moody's, right? They rate corporate debt. They are just surfing the permanent historic expansion of global credit markets. The demand for their service just arrives at their doorstep as the market naturally grows.
Now, take those free surfers and examine how they actually behave when you introduce high inflation into the system, because this completely inverts the conventional Wall Street wisdom.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because inflation doesn't actually hurt them.
Yeah.
How does inflation impact the free B?
it mathematically rewards it. Let's go back to the A, the current toll, right?
Okay.
Visa takes a percentage fee of the transaction. When inflation hits, the nominal value of literally everything goes up. If a gallon of milk goes from $3 to $5, Visa's cut of that swipe increases proportionally.
And they didn't have to do anything.
Nothing. Their revenue rises automatically without them changing their business model at all.
And because their costs are largely fixed-like, they don't have a massive physical supply chain to maintain, that extra revenue just falls straight to the bottom line.
Exactly. But what about the B, the growth side of it?
The growth continues completely uninterrupted. And here is the real magic of the free B. Because there is no factory to build, there is no capital expenditure to inflate.
Wow.
Their 65% net profit margins hold incredibly steady because they literally have no cost of goods sold to inflate. They aren't buying steel. They aren't extracting oil. They aren't employing a massive physical labor force to process that extra dollar of inflated transaction value.
So let me make sure I've got this straight. The free surfer mathematically benefits from inflation because their toll scales with price hikes, while their growth costs them absolutely nothing.
Correct.
But the expensive B is mathematically punished by inflation because their capital expenditures compound way faster than their pricing power.
That is the core thesis, yes.
If this is true, why on earth is the broader market actively selling the free surfers and buying the expensive Bs every single time inflation spikes? It makes no sense.
It's a phenomenon the author calls the rotation error. And it is the ultimate tragic irony of that 50-year-old Wall Street playbook.
Because they're just blindly following the spreadsheet.
Right. Because analysts are driven by those arbitrary spreadsheet categories we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They see the inflation data and they panic.
Right.
They mechanically sell Visa, the exact business perfectly engineered to surf inflation, because its P/E ratio flags it as growth.
And they take all the capital from selling Visa and they rotate it straight into Exxon at a P/E of 12, just because the spreadsheet says Exxon is value.
Exactly.
They do this despite the fact that Exxon is staring down the barrel of $25 billion a year in capital expenditures that inflation is making vastly more expensive.
They're essentially buying the victim of inflation and selling the primary beneficiary of it.
It's just wild.
And this error compounds when you look at the other classic defensive sectors the market rotates into during these panics. Take utilities, for example.
Right. Utilities have always been pitched as the ultimate safe haven. You know, the logic is that people will always need to keep the lights on, no matter what the economy is doing.
The demand is stable, yes. But look at the insides of the business. Utilities face aggressively rising raw fuel costs, rising union labor costs, and rising maintenance costs for a grid that's constantly aging.
All of which inflate heavily.
Yes. But here's the catch. Their pricing is heavily regulated. They cannot simply raise prices tomorrow to cover today's inflated costs.
Oh, right. They have to get approval.
They have to go to a government utility board, submit a proposal, and literally beg for permission to raise rates. That process takes months, sometimes years.
So their pricing always lags dangerously behind the reality of their inflation. That's a huge trap.
It is.
And we see a similar trap with consumer staples, right? The classic advice is, well, people still need to buy toothpaste and cereal, so rotate into consumer staples.
But those companies are dealing with an incredibly expensive B right now.
How so?
They're burning billions of dollars on advertising just to defend their legacy brands against really high quality private label store brand.
Oh, yeah. The store brands are getting really good.
Right. And meanwhile, their underlying input costs, the wheat, the sugar, the plastic packaging, the transportation, all of that is soaring faster than they can raise prices on the grocery store shelf without totally alienating the consumer.
So if the math is this clear, and it really seems undeniable when you break it down like this, why do highly educated Wall Street professionals, you know, people who stare at financial models literally all day long, keep making this rotation error? How did a playbook this fundamentally flawed become institutional gospel?
It all comes down to a very specific, very powerful psychological trap, availability bias.
Okay.
And in finance, that bias is rooted entirely in the ghost of the 1970s. For the last 50 years, when portfolio managers think about severe inflation, they immediately reference the 1970s.
And the 1970s were defined by stagflation, which is like the absolute nightmare scenario, right? High inflation coupled with high unemployment and flat or contracting consumer demand.
Exactly. Stagflation is a uniquely destructive environment. In a period of normal, localized inflation, the broader economy might still be growing. Strong consumer demand can sometimes mask the underlying cane of the expensive bee.
Because companies can just pass the costs along for a while.
Right. But stagflation offers absolutely no escape.
Because demand is contracting, people are losing their jobs, so you literally can't raise the price of your product. But your input costs are still skyrocketing. Your margins just completely collapse.
And if you look at the historical data from that specific decade, value stocks technically outperform growth stocks. Analysts like Russell Napier and others, they frequently point to those exact charts to justify the modern playbook.
Right.
They say, look at the data. This is how you survive inflation.
Wait, so you're telling me the entire multi-trillion-dollar market playbook is essentially pattern matching from a sample size of exactly one decade, a decade that happened half a century ago?
Yes. The graphs from the 70s exist, so the industry just assumes they dictate a universal law that will automatically repeat.
That's terrible.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture and look at the actual mechanics, the market took entirely the wrong lesson from the 1970s.
So what should they have learned?
The 1970s did not punish growth as a monolithic category. The 1970s punished the expensive bee. The businesses that required massive, continuous capital expenditure to expand, the businesses that depended on endlessly reinvesting their own earnings just to maintain their market share, those were the companies that were destroyed by stagflation.
And the ones that survived.
The businesses that survived were the ones that could grow without spending capital. It just so happened that in the 1970s, the growth label was heavily applied to incredibly capital-intensive industries.
That is a massive distinction. So 50 years of arguing about value versus growth, 50 years of academic research, endless fund rebalancing, complex financial modeling, it was all an argument over the wrong question entirely.
The label on the dust jacket is not the reality of the book. The true cost of the company's future, the cost of the bee, is the only reality that actually matters when inflationary pressure is applied.
Wow. So let's bring this all together. We've talked about index funds, multi-billion dollar corporations, 50-year-old financial history. But what does this paradigm shift actually mean for you, the listener, trying to navigate this environment?
Well, it means you have to discard the old binary. As the research clearly states, the debate between value and growth is dead. It is a dangerous distraction.
Good riddance.
Right. The only question that holds any weight now is this. Does the business have to pay for its future, or does the future arrive for free?
Because inflation does not inherently punish growth.
No, it punishes the expensive bee. It actively, mathematically rewards the toll that rises with nominal prices, and it rewards the structural wave that carries a business forward without requiring capital expenditure.
The free surfer doesn't try to build a wall to fight inflation. It just surfs it. And I think there's a profoundly applicable takeaway here that goes far beyond just, you know, rebalancing a stock portfolio. Think about the library analogy one last time.
Yeah.
If you spend your life categorizing things by their surface level labels, you are going to be completely blind to how the machinery actually operates under the hood. You have to look at the underlying mechanics of what it costs to sustain a system.
And that principle applies to almost any complex system, whether it's corporate finance or personal resource management.
Exactly. And that is the final thought I want to leave you with today. Don't just apply this framework to the stock market. Apply it to your own career or your own personal business ventures.
That's a really interesting way to look at it.
Yeah. Look at the specific skills you're spending time building right now. Look at the projects you're managing. Are you operating your own life like an expensive bee?
Constantly reinvesting just to stay afloat.
Exactly. Are you constantly having to burn all your energy, your weekends, your personal resources just to tread water and maintain your current position? Or can you find a way to become a free surfer in your own career?
Positioning yourself in front of a wave.
Right. Can you position yourself in front of a structural, inevitable wave in your industry where your future growth, your next promotion, or your next big opportunity arrives naturally without you having to constantly pay for it in burnout?
It's all about finding leverage rather than just applying more force.
Definitely something to seriously consider the next time you hear the financial news anchors panicking about inflation, or just the next time you are evaluating your own trajectory. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the mechanics of growth. We will catch you next time.